live around the world. This is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
I'm the one you love. I'm Jay. Thanks so much for stopping by. Over there's Brad. It's his show.
That's why I'm the host, and we just love Jay.
Now you know it's all natural. I mean, you know, nothing's rehearsed, right?
No, absolutely nothing is rehearsed on this show.
God, you just suck life out of here. It feels like
you've got a lot grayer since we started this.
I have.
This evening, welcome to the program, David Joy. We are live.
Happy Friday, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Paper Cuts. I'm Jay. That's Brad over there. I don't know how we got this interview. I still don't know how. I'm still wondering about how. I know. I mean, we owe some people some money somewhere. This evening, we have the author of several of your favorite books. Where all light tends to go, The Line That Held Us, When These Mountains Burn. And of course, we're going to be talking about
this new one today.
The new one, Those We Thought We Knew. Look at that. Everyone, welcome to the program, David Joy. David, thank you so much for agreeing to hang out with two dopes with microphones here tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. That intro, I thought we was about to enter a wrestling ring.
We should, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens with that. What's the release? August 1st, right?
Or
first,
yeah, Tuesday.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, next great. Tuesday.
All right. Gearing up for making your rounds.
Yeah. I've spent the last week in Hyman, Kentucky at the Hyman Settlement School teaching some writing workshops, and then I'm home for a couple of days and then hit the road again next week.
Nice. Yeah, making your rounds, get the book out there and teach it at the same time. Great.
Yeah. Which is a bit odd for me because I'm not a teacher. And so that was the warning going into the class, was it's like, I'm not a teacher. So it was mostly a lot of cussing and me trying to, you know, help them figure out their own process, I think.
A different kind of teaching than what they're used to. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. But yeah. Effective nonetheless. So
we'll hope so.
So we'll go ahead. We'll dive into the book since we don't have a ton of time today, but the very opening line, just, I don't want to say what it is. I'll let readers figure that out for themselves, but I was hooked from that first sentence. I think it's only like six or seven words. So when you're crafting a book, when you're writing a book, do you really worry about trying to start with like the perfect opening sentence, or you just, whatever comes to mind, you just let that go and don't really worry about drawing them in instantly? Or
I think absolutely. And there are certain ones that really stand out. You know, I think that one does. When I really think about probably the best opening line I ever wrote, it was that opening line of The Weight of This World. And the opening line of that novel was Aidan McCall was 12 years old the one time he heard I Love You, which is just a fucked up statement, it's the kind of statement that completely sets the mood. You know so much about him in an instant. I think I'm always trying to think about, that kind of line. In that workshop this past week, we were talking about opening lines and like Donald Ray Pollock's, you know, one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the opening line of a story of his called The Dynamite Hole. And I can't remember. I think his name's Truman Mackey, or it's Truman something. But he was coming across, it says he was coming across the Mitchell Flats. He had his hand in his pocket and he was rubbing Airheads in his pocket. And it said he had a dead copperhead wrapped across his neck like an old woman's scarf. When I came across the Mitchell Flats and saw Billy Mackey fucking his own little sister in the dynamite hole is the opening line. And it's like, man, if you read that opening line and you don't want to read the second, me and you aren't the same person.
Yeah, something's wrong with you.
Absolutely.
That reels you in. That keeps you invested just right there.
Yeah.
So, is that something that's probably taught, right? And like writing courses. I don't know if you teach it when you're out doing your teaching, but like that first line can really set the whole thing. And, you know, once you grab somebody, you go from there. That first line, you gotta, it's special usually, right?
Yeah. And I think there's lots of ways to enter into a story, and get to that hook. But when I think about some of my favorites, you know, Daniel Woodrell or certainly somebody like Donald Ray Pollock, Donald Ray Pollock's going to hit you in the head with a hammer the minute you open the book.
Right.
You know, and it's not, there's not going to be a waiting game. It's not going to be two paragraphs in. It's going to be the first line, you know, and so I really love that style. You know, I there's nothing subtle about me, and there's nothing really subtle about my writing.
So Dalton Ray Pollock's one writer that you're kind of looking up to, kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah,
and I'm a big fan of him too. And come to find out, I mean, he lives like an hour from me, so I may have to go camp out on his, you know, lawn for an interview. But we might do that sometime.
Yeah, I bet we could set that up. Because Don's a friend of mine, you know, and I loved his work. You know, especially early on with you know, Knock 'Em Stiff. But when I think about my favorite novels of the past, you know, I don't know, 10 years, the one it's hard to say it's my absolute favorite, but The Heavenly Table. Like, I love that book, you know, and I want another book from Don bad.
Yeah. It's always an argument of Donald Ray Pollock fans because, like, half say The Devil All the Time, like me, and the other half say Heavenly Table, and it's always like a back and forth, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody's right, really. It's just your own, but those two go back and forth between the Pollock fans, which one that their favorite is. So
Yeah.
So I watched your the first episode of the PBS special, The Southern Storytellers, that you're on.
Yeah.
And you had I think you were reading a quote from like an essay you'd written before. You said, when I sit down to begin a story, the canvas isn't blank in that there's already a place. There are already mountains and streams and buildings and roads, so that when a character finally arises, the character calls himself from the ground, and that place for me is Jackson County, North Carolina. So is the setting for you, is that always what comes first when a new story comes out?
You know, I think a lot of writers are constantly working to create a world, And a lot of times maybe that world is created from pulling lots of different things together and kind of making this amalgamation of all these different places. And then sometimes I think people create a world that is very much a mirror image of something they know. And for me, it was that, all of that seemed like a waste of time. And it was because, like, when the story arrived in my head, I knew where they were standing. Like, so again, yeah, I mentioned The Weight of This World, but, at the beginning of that novel, those two boys are standing under this group of balsams at the top of Sugar Creek Gap. And like when that image appeared in my mind, I knew where they were standing. It wasn't an imaginary place. It was a very real place. You know, and I know this landscape and I know this county in a really intimate way, and so the people and the images are all attached to that. And because of that, you know, this place has its own sound. And so, you know, the characters are, that's how they talk. You know, it's not a North Georgia accent. It's not a Mississippi accent. It's not even a, you know, an Asheville accent. It's very indicative of Jackson County.
Right. I was looking up, City Light Books earlier, because I was wanting to see if they shipped out to places and stuff. I saw they were in Silver, North Carolina, and I just Googled the city, and the first picture that popped up, it's like from the hilltop, and you're looking down on Main Street, and there's a statue there. And I instantly knew what that was because of what happened in the book. I'd never seen it before. So what you just said, you take the real place and you inject it into the book. You know, I instantly knew what that was because of the way you describe it in your story, and that's the Silva Sam is, I don't know if you named it that.
Yeah, that, no, that's the name of it, Silva Sam. Yeah. Now, the funny thing about that is, you know, I wrote the first parts of this new novel, and the very first scene I ever wrote was Cawthorn. It was that the second chapter of, you know, when the police find this man drunk and passed out in his car.
Right.
He's not from around here, and they find out, you know, that he's a member of the Klan. And one, that's based on a true story of something a deputy told me in this county. But I wrote that, you know, somewhere around 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And you know, something interesting happened, which is that, you know, I was writing all of it. Most of those scenes were written in like 2018, 2019. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden 2020 happens, you know, and we have Ahmaud Arbery chased down and murdered in the streets and shot like a dog. You know, you jump forward a month, we have Breonna Taylor there in Kentucky, you know, where you are. You know, you jump forward a couple more months, you have Ahmaud Arbery, and the world watches a police officer kneel on his neck for close to 9 minutes. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the world reaches this fracture point. And it was something that played out in Jackson County. And so a ton of the things that I had fictionalized and made up started happening in real life. And it was this, it was debilitating as a writer, because I couldn't, there was no more separation. Like I couldn't separate the world that I'd created from what I was witnessing outside my door. And it wasn't like I was some fortune teller or something, right? I mean, it was that this is the kind of thing that if you grow up in the American South, you've witnessed over and over again over the course of your lifetime. It was really, I think that a lot of people are going to read this book and they're going to think that it was inspired by the things that happened that year. And that's okay. You know, I don't know that it changes anything, you know, but really, you know, it was happening before that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm one of those. When I was reading it, I thought it was because of what was being brought to the spotlight for a change. But I mean, like you said, it's always happened. It seems like, you know, there's more time on our hands, so now it's coming to a spotlight, and things are happening. And this, I want to, you know, say it's kind of a change of direction for some of your previous works, because a lot of them deal with drug issues you're talking about a lot of racial tension in this book. How did you make that transition? I mean, it seems like you were doing it before a lot of the stories that are in the news, but so you were readying yourself for that transition to begin with and tackling a whole new different world, basically.
I think that there was a transition that really happened with that last novel, with When These Mountains Burn, where suddenly it was, you know, I think about like the book, The Line That Held Us. There's no drugs in that book at all. It was very much a book. And I wanted to number one, create a really interesting and memorable, antagonist. I wanted Lester Ballard. I wanted, you know, O'Connor's misfit. I wanted somebody we would remember. You know, and then when it came time for When These Mountains Burn, that novel was very much a social novel in the sense that it was about the opioid epidemic, and it was about how that played out in the place that I live. And it was really personal because, you know, I was surrounded by it every day of my life. You know, I'd get out at the post office and there'd be, you know, 100 needles laying in the parking lot.
Yeah.
You know, I was seeing the police and medics pull bodies from out from under bridges. But what I'm getting at is that there was this transition that took place then where all of a sudden the novel started taking on more of a social atmosphere and social context. And I can remember being on a panel once with Megan Abbott, which, you know, I think Megan Abbott's just one of America's best. I mean, she's brilliant. But Megan Abbott said that the crime novel, perhaps more than any other novel, you know, lended itself very well to be the social novel. And I think that's a really good way to think about it. You know, you think about Sean Cosby's latest book and largely it's dealing with a lot of these same issues. Right. Yeah. But he's finding his way into those issues through these other elements. And so for me, I think that's largely kind of how that shift happened and why it happened and what I was trying to do.
Good.
With this one, you're doing a lot with, you know, like racism, white privilege, you know, heritage and stuff. So was this for you, was this the most difficult book for you to write?
Absolutely. And it's because of what was at stake. It's because when you're writing about these kind of things, it's not only that you can make a mistake, but it's that the mistake can do real harm to real people. It can perpetuate things. You know, so for instance, I'm just going to use this as an example, but like there's this very long tradition of white writers and white entertainers using Black death as spectacle. mm-hmm. right? Like there's a ton of examples of this, you know, and so that was something I was constantly aware of. And so the question becomes, how do you do the things that I'm trying to do while being completely aware of that? And it was this balancing act. Mm-hmm. Because what the book was really trying to do was to force white characters into difficult conversations, you know, in mm-hmm. conversations that they weren't having. And the sad reality is that the only time white America seems to want to talk about any of these problems is you know, in the aftermath of Black death and Black trauma. Mm-hmm. And so the fiction had to reflect that reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you were doing this, I mean, those were some of the worries did you have any of those worries? Like, okay, I have to do it this way. Did you make changes because you thought maybe the first way you did it may have been wrong or come across wrong? Any kind of worries like that?
I think worry may be the wrong word, in that I think that a writer has to operate from a state of fearlessness mm-hmm. and a state of extreme vulnerability.
Right.
I think it's more that I was operating from like an extreme awareness. Like I knew so much of the things that I needed to be paying attention to. So like the structure of this book, that the structure doesn't exist if I'm not wrestling with, for instance, that idea of Black death as spectacle, uh-huh. you know, and so there's this awareness. And then the other side of this is that, you know, one, I was fortunate to work with a really great editor, mm-hmm. and two, Putnam was generous enough to, you know, to pay an authenticity reader to work with me, mm-hmm. you know, and it was somebody who was able to add so much context to things and force me to look at things that maybe I hadn't thought of, and force me to re-examine things that I had thought of. Mm-hmm. You know, I can remember them telling me that the average authenticity read response is somewhere around a page and a half. And mine was 20 pages, single spaced, with piles of footnotes, right? Like it was just so thorough and thoughtful. And when I got it, like when you get something like that, like you can't take it with any sort of defensiveness. You know, you have to think about every single thing they're bringing to the table. And when I think about some of the, and there were changes that were made as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And it, I think it served the novel.
I was going to ask that, if you had like sensitivity reader or authenticity reader, and like I said, worry or fear may not be the right word, but was there any hesitation or anything maybe on your part that it would come across as you're not the right person to tell this story, since you are a white male and you're talking about you know, white privilege and racism and stuff? Were you, did you ever, again, not maybe trepidation, maybe fear is not the right word, but you know, anything like that?
Well, so first I would say that I'm the only person who can tell this story, okay. because the story is, as I said, it's a matter of forcing white characters into this conversation. One of the big questions for me became, can you write about a book about race that is primarily, if not solely, intended for a white audience?
Okay.
And I wrestled with that for a really long time. And that's not to say that should a black reader engage with the text, that the story and the characterization shouldn't ring true. But that mm-hmm. is to say that the things we're wrestling with in this book have been lived, understood, discussed ad nauseum by that community. And so I kept going back to this interview with Toni Morrison and Charlie Rose, where Toni Morrison, you know, told Charlie Rose, she said, white people have a problem. And this is 1993 that this interview took place, almost 30 years to the day. But she says, white people have a problem and you need to take me out of it. Mm-hmm. And I just kept thinking, 30 years later, we've still refused to address our problem. And it's our problem. You know, when I think about the work that this novel's trying to do, the truth is that it's remedial work. Mm-hmm. Like we're trying to convince people that this, that something like systemic racism even exists. Right. And that's, right. That is remedial work. In my opinion, you can't ask somebody as brilliant as Nicole Hannah Jones to explain that to people. Mm-hmm. You can't ask Ibram X. Kendi to waste his time explaining that to people. Like, he has more important work to do. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about, you know, who needed to write this novel, it's absolutely me and people like me, because we're the ones who need to be having this conversation.
Okay.
So touching on that, and this, there may not be a real answer for this, but did you learn anything about other people or even learn anything about yourself once you finished writing this book? Anything new that you didn't know about yourself before going into this project?
I think that, like, I don't believe that there was some moment of self-discovery or illumination.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I say that is because, like, we are stuck in a feedback loop. Like, this is nothing new. Like, maybe 2020 was the major moment for you, but that's because you weren't alive at the same time I was alive. You know, the first time I remember seeing something like that play out on the news, it was Rodney King. You know, and we can, you don't have to go that far back, you know,
mm-hmm.
pick a year, you know, and we'll find a name. This is not something new. This is something that takes place over and over and over again. And we have a serious problem of continuing to sweep it under the rug. And just, I think Americans in general, like, we despise the idea of being made uncomfortable. And so it's like, well, if we don't look at it, it'll go away. If we don't talk about it, it'll go away. And quite obviously that's not the case. Obviously, you know, the repetitive nature of it, the cyclical nature of it all, you know, demands that we try something different. And what we need to try is laying all of that ugly out on the table and dealing with it. And when I think about those characters, that this is the other thing, though, is that if I approach that text as a reader, I think there are moments that I, as a reader, would place judgment on some of the conversations that are happening. But as a writer, that I should never be able to do that. And so I hope that each aspect of that conversation takes place within the page without judgment from my end.
Right.
It's perfectly fine for either of you to read the book and have an opinion and think, yeah, that guy's full of shit, or fuck him, or whatever you want to think. And that's perfectly fine. But from a writing standpoint, I can't do that.
Yeah. I really like that. You know, obviously, like, the KKK is in here, but they're not even really like the main antagonist. No, it's more like the subtle racism of the, and it's more insidious than that, like the snide remark that someone ignores and you hopes it goes away. And was it challenging to write that more sort of insidious racism as opposed to, you know, the big bad villains, the KKK with the hood on and, you know, the torches? And this is more, you know, could be, you know, your neighbor or the teacher or the preacher's wife that's doing this instead, not, you know, a more faceless.
Yeah, it was layered too. So that's I like that presentation of it. So,
yeah, so I'm glad that comes across, because, like, you know, what I was trying to do was think about white supremacy as an onion and, like, just peeling layers back. And the truth is that somebody like the character of Willie Dean Cawthorn, you know, this, you know, blatant racist, you know, this overt racist, that's some papery thin bullshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the fucking top layer of the onion.
Yeah.
And you can wipe that shit off with your hand and set it aside. That's not what is eating this place apart. You know, what's eating this place apart is the subtlety. It's the silence.
Yeah.
You know, and all of us are complicit in it, right? Like, I want to make that clear. This isn't like moral superiority on my end, as if this is something that I've never been a part of. I've been a part of it all my life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. and anybody who's being honest has been complicit in the silence at one point or another. You know, and so for me, it was about not only pulling the layers back, but examining each layer for what it was, and just trying to see the whole picture. I think you're absolutely right. Like for me, one of the major points is that the most dangerous things are those silent things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It can almost be so subtle that you don't even know you're doing it. Like you don't even know that you're complicit in it almost.
Yeah. And just to touch on that, I mean, it kind of plays in with the politics of today. Like you don't hear, I mean, nobody talks about it until something happens. And that's how ties up with the story. They don't, as a town, they don't talk about it because it's so subtle until something happens. Then it comes to, you know, the top of everyone's mouth, just like the real world. We don't talk about anything like that until another instance. And then it's always like, oh, what are we going to do? And then it dies down and then it happens again. And it's in full circle each time. So,
yeah. Definitely. And I think the way that it's playing out in this country politically right now is that, anything that is being voiced threatens the power structure, you know, because what we're talking about is ingrained in every system of power that exists in this country. You know, this country was founded upon and perpetuated by white supremacy, whether we want to agree with that or not. It's just a fact. You know, it's ingrained in us. And so when you look at things that are happening, like what's taking place in Florida, or you look at the book bans, or you look at all of these things that are taking place, it's very much the reason they want you dumb is so that you remain silent, because you can't know the fucking truth and stay silent. You can't know the fucking truth and not be like livid, you know, and filled with rage. Right. And so I think, you know, the fact that they're working so hard to keep all of these books out of kids' hands and out of people's hands in general. The fact that something like the 1619 Project is being banned from history classes, you know, is the root of the problem.
Yeah.
And when they erase the history like that, then we're going to be doomed to repeat it. You know, all these things they're trying to take away that. Oh, let's forget about it, and it's just going to come, like you said, it's a loop. It's going to come back right back around.
Well, and we're perpetually repeating it. You know, I think the one thing about, you know, that idea of if you don't pay attention to history, you're bound to repeat it. With us, the cyclical nature, there is no distance in time, right? Like we're not talking about, you know, 100 years this happens again. We're talking about, you know,
every day.
Think about mass shootings in this country, right?
Right.
Like, this year is worse than it's ever been. Like we continue to learn nothing. And by the time, you know, the other thing about this is that all of these things happen so often that it's very hard to even hold it in your hand. Like it's fucking fluid.
You get desensitized to it. It happens so much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the time you start trying to have the conversation, something else has happened and the conversation has shifted. The context has changed. Yeah. And so I think it's a really difficult time. But I also know for a fact that we're damn sure not going to do anything if we just continue to sit here and fucking twiddle our thumbs.
Yeah. I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but the church that's in the book, which is sort of like the genesis of what is kind of happening, the Kolowihi African butchered. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No,
African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church that was quote unquote relocated back in 1929. That is a real thing, event that happened, and that's mentioned in the book. That's sort of the beginning of the book, you know, the genesis and what is sort of going on with it. So, did you have the event in mind before you started writing it, or did you start writing this? Oh, that would fit perfectly into this, you know, situation for Toya Gardner.
Yeah. So I'm in Kolowi right now, and I'm within, it would take me about 5 minutes to walk to where the site of the original church was and where the site of the original cemetery was. But in the very beginning, no, I didn't have that history, that I was working with. I had the character of Toya. Uh-huh. And then this moment happened where I was with a visual artist friend of mine named Marie Cochran, who the book is dedicated to. And she took me up there and showed me that. And so suddenly I had this history, and it became a way, to cement her to this place so that she wasn't just somebody visiting, who was gonna, bring some of these things to the surface. She was very rooted to this place. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I was wanting to do anyways, largely because, when we think about Appalachia, Appalachia to anybody who ain't from here looks like me, right? Big, ugly white dude, big beard, probably got overalls. That's Appalachia. And the truth is that, there's so much diversity within this region. Mm-hmm. You think about writers like Crystal Wilkinson. You think about writers like Nima Avashia. If you were to ask somebody in California, if there were, Indian lesbians in the, in Appalachia, they'd be like, no. And it's like, of course there are. Like, you need to read Nima. Like, Nima's writing that reality beautifully. And the name of her book's Another Appalachia, if anybody's listening and would like to read it. But anyways, mm-hmm. I was trying to address some of the whitewashing that has happened, to mm-hmm. this place, and Jackson County, we've always, we still do, we still have a fairly large Black community in this county, and when you go back, that community was larger. It actually shifted kind of in the 40s and 50s as it did in a lot of places. People left for jobs and things like that. But the reality is that church is one of the oldest churches in this county. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to work with that. I think a lot of times people think that being bound to a place like Jackson County would be a limitation. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's like, that I can't imagine a story I couldn't tell here. Yeah. It's very, they asked James Joyce, they said, why do you only write about Dublin? And he said, 'cause if I can get to the heart of Dublin, I can get to the heart of all cities of the world. And that's the truth, right? Like, you're just trying to tell a human story. And so for me, it's about trying to capture this place for what it is. And it's about trying to let a singular place, speak for something much larger.
Yeah. And you being from there, it lends such a bigger authenticity to your stories as well. Instead of, typing, I'm going to research California and add that to my book. You're from this place. You know it. I think you said you're like 12 generations, your families live there. So it's like ingrained in your own blood, this place. And that comes across really beautifully on the page. I think the Jackson County, North Carolina, or just Appalachia in general as a character itself in your books.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually didn't grow up in Jackson County. I grew up east, about 100 miles east. Mm-hmm. I've been here a little over half my life, but 12th generation North Carolinian, all of my family kind of settled in and around the Catawba River Basin, mid 1700s, mm-hmm. first ancestor comes into North Carolina in late 1600s. And with how that sort of, ties into this book, it's like, I say that as a matter of pride, I'm proud of that. Yeah. But you can't make a statement about being a 12th generation white man in this country and that not also be something that most assuredly holds a whole lot of fucking horrible, right? Mm-hmm. Which is to say that I come from enslavers. It's to say that most of my ancestors fought to preserve the institution of enslavement. Mm. And I think that's the thing that I'm wrestling with. That's the thing that most people in the South are wrestling with. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not a far off history,
right?
It's never left. It's part of our everyday life now. And even in terms of You know, Sean Cosby posted something, I think, it was this week for sure, but it was on Twitter, and it was a picture of one of his, I think it may be his great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. But think about that. You know, we're talking, his great-grandmother was enslaved. We're not talking about far, far off.
No.
You know, and I think that's something, you know, that finds its way into all Southern literature. You know, you can't have been born in the American South and not have been greatly influenced by all of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's okay to be, you know, proud of where you come from and your family, but also recognize that there's faults that come along with that.
And absolutely,
you know, balancing those two out, because no one's perfect. You know, we're not perfect. Our ancestors weren't perfect. So to recognize the faults, even though you're proud of your heritage, where you come from, there's probably some, you know, like you said, bad things that went along with it.
Yeah. And I think we make a bad mistake when people try to twist that into saying, using a term like white guilt or shame. Like, I'm not fucking ashamed of it. And I'm most assuredly not, I don't feel guilty about it. I didn't fucking do it.
Right.
Right. But complete without actively acknowledging it and saying that it was wrong, you're being complicit. The silence is the complicity. And that's what I mean about just laying the ugly out on the table. Lay it out there and we'll deal with it. It's not doing any of us any good keeping that shit in our pocket.
David, I know you got to hop out here because you're a pretty popular guy and you got 25 other interviews lined up, but I wanted to, again, August 1st, this book really is passionate and it's going to have conversations created from reading this. I think, I know me and Brad were talking about it behind the scenes and stuff. So pretty, powerful, passionate, book. So August 1st, everyone can check their, you know, mark their calendars and get ready for that and order it. Go to your favorite bookshop, get to the however you can. But David, thank you so much for hanging out with us. We really appreciate it.
Go to citylightsnc.com and it's David's local bookstore. Get you a copy there.
Yeah.
And they'll mail it out to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Thanks so much for hanging out with two dopes with microphones here. We appreciate it. So
I appreciate y'all having me. Let's do it again.
Definitely.
You care
definitely
about we will. One last question real quick.
Go for it.
So if there's anything a reader, anything that you would hope a reader would take away from this or learn from this, what would it be?
There's not like a message that I want you to, you know, walk away with, but the thing that I want you to do with this book and that I want you to do with books in general is that when you have an emotional response to a book, whatever that may be. And with this book, I think a lot of people are going to at one point or another experience anger. It's perfectly fine to feel that. Like, I want you to feel that. And I want you to sit with it. And I want you to question why the book made you feel that way. Why did what took place in the scene make you feel that way?
Right.
Because that's really the power of literature and of art in general, but most assuredly literature and fiction, is that it provides and creates a safe place for us to encounter very difficult ideas, you know, and to do so with no expectation. You know, it's just you and the book. It's a perfect space to sit with the hard shit, because the truth is that if we try to have those conversations at the table, a lot of times people get defensive and defensiveness turns to anger. But if you're getting angry with a book, you got nobody. That's absolutely right. So sit with it.
David Joy, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Everyone in the chat, thank you so much for hanging out with us and rewatch this many times in the future. It's been a good episode. David, thanks so much again. That's a wrap, David, guys.
Really appreciate you, man. On sale August 1st. Yes. Go out and get it wherever books are sold. See you, David.
We'll see
you, Jay. Love you, man.
I know you do. See ya.